So maybe this is starting on a negative note, but I want to cover some of the failure modes that I see us falling into in this community, and you know, some solutions that we may be able to sort of apply to those failure modes. And they broadly fall under the category of optimizing for the wrong thing, optimizing for individual impact and short-term impact. What can I do now to make some splash or make some impact? Whereas I think we should be focusing more on what can we collectively do in coordination with each other as a community? What can we do over the longer term? So rather than figuring out how to do the most good this year or next year, really focusing on what can we do over our lifetimes and what can the movement do, you know, beyond that. There are three main categories that I think these sort of failure modes fall into that I'm going to cover today. One is that we're in something of an echo chamber. I see people running themselves down more than I think is a good idea. And there are some discussion norms we have in this community that I think could use some help. So this echo chamber is where we as a community end up attracting the same kinds of people over and over, meaning that we have the same kinds of discussions over and over and end up trying to do the same types of projects over and over, which probably isn't the best thing that we could be doing compared to trying a wider range of things. There are three things that I see going on here. So founder effect, which I'll explain these all a bit more. Sorry, I'm throwing a lot of sort of theoretical names out here. Shelling segregation and something that I call selecting for the correlates. So founder effect in biology is where you have a small population that initially sort of, or a small number of individuals that found a population. And the resulting population ends up having very limited genetic diversity because it had few founding members. I think that that can happen in a social way as well. So when a community is started by a few people, maybe in similar fields or with similar backgrounds, those people recruit their friends, the friends recruit their friends, and you can end up with a movement that basically resembles the founders in a lot of ways. So, for example, if you are founded by a bunch of English-speaking guys in their 20s who are all in backgrounds of philosophy, tech, and finance, maybe math in there as well, then you're naturally going to end up with a population, if nobody, you know, tries to do anything different, that basically resembles those founders. Actually, I want to say a bit more about that. So I think that that can hamper us in a bunch of ways, partly when we want to do projects that affect the world, we need a complex understanding of how the world functions. And if our view of the world is really only informed by a few disciplines, for example, we're just not going to get a very full picture of how things really work. We're not going to have all the knowledge that we as a community need to have the most impact that we can. To give an example, Charity Science is an organization that is right now working to found a public health project in India. It sounds like a great project. Their staff is mostly Americans and Canadians, none of whom have a background in India or much knowledge of how things work there. They're doing their best to learn. They're also looking for a staff member who has that kind of background, who has the linguistic knowledge, the cultural knowledge, the like actual lived experience that will help that project succeed, because it's just really hard to do if you don't have those experiences. And you are, you know, coming from Vancouver to come and, you know, run something in an environment where you just don't have much understanding of how stuff works on the ground. I think that's the kind of situation, like particularly in EA's work on, you know, global health and development, where we really could stand to be broader than a bunch of people primarily from the developed world. So Thomas Schelling described a model of segregation that can happen by mistake. And to be clear, I think the founder model also is something that happens unintentionally. I don't think anybody's doing this on purpose. So he described a method of sort of modeling human behavior where you take different colored pieces, lay them out on a checkerboard, give them some space to move around. If you give the pieces even a small preference for their own kind, let's say that they don't want to be outnumbered more than 3 to 1, and if they are outnumbered by 3 to 1, they'll move to the nearest space where that's not the case. you can start out with a very integrated, like totally randomized, you know, mixing of those two colors. And once you've applied that rule, they end up almost completely segregated. So even a very mild preference for one's own kind can quickly yield like completely different clumps of people. So if you have a party where you have journalism majors and computer science majors, if those people have even a slight preference for talking to people from their own group, you can quickly end up with essentially two different parties happening at your party. And I think, you know, this has happened to some extent in this community that without really intending it, people naturally find it easy to talk to people who resemble them in various ways, and we've ended up being more clumped than is really good for our effectiveness. It's nice for like social comfort, you know, it feels sort of comfortable and easy to talk to people who are similar to you, but that's not necessarily what's best for actually getting stuff done. Then there's something I call selecting for the correlates. So when we're thinking about who would be great to, you know, have in this movement? Who of the people that I know would I like to talk to about, you know, the ideas of effective altruism, and who should I try to get interested in this? We probably think about people who resemble those already in the movement. So people who are a similar age, maybe they went to the same universities, they studied the similar subjects. They may read the same web comics and watch the same Netflix. These are all things that just kind of like unconsciously, you know, make us think of like, okay, this is the kind of person that I already know is in EA, so they'll probably like fit in well here. That strategy does work to find people who probably like will have a good time at EA parties and you know, enjoy reading articles or something like that. But it probably isn't the best strategy. So there's evidence, for example, with job interviews that when you interview a candidate, a lot of what interviewers end up selecting for unconsciously is just like, how similar to me is this person? So they want somebody who's like attractive and who like finds the same jokes funny, things like that, that really are not correlated with job performance. They're just correlated with, you know, sort of what do I already find pleasant or similar to me in various ways. And really don't have much to do with actual performance. So I think when you do this, you may end up with people who have similar demographic characteristics, but those people aren't necessarily particularly values aligned with EA. So I think of the kind of person who would be a great fit for EA as people who are analytic and who are motivated by altruism. And that describes a lot of people out there. It doesn't say a lot about your preference for what Netflix you watch or, you know, whatever other sort of characteristics make us feel at home with somebody or feel that they're similar to us. I think it also can yield a really lopsided talent pool. So if we're primarily recruiting people who, say, have experience in certain disciplines, currently I think we're missing out on a lot of disciplines that we really need more people with these skills. I think we could use more people with management skills and experience, policy work, people with media experience, and marketing. I think, you know, we can have great ideas all day long, but if like we don't know how to tell people about those or get the message out, or if our organizations don't have staff who like know how to run an organization, we're gonna be less effective than we would if we had a broad range of skills and could, you know, run different areas smoothly rather than having all our talent concentrated in one area. I think when we select one kind of person or the kind of person who looks sort of similar, we give the impression that this movement is only for that kind of person. So, you know, people sometimes will ask me, say, because I have children, they'll be like, is that like an okay thing to do? Like, can EAs have children? And I mean, there are a lot of ethical questions there, but for me, it really comes down to, this cannot be a movement for only one kind of person. It cannot be a movement for only parents, only non-parents. People ask me, like, is it okay to buy a house? Like, this cannot be a movement only for people who do or do not own houses. It cannot be a movement only for people who read, like, the same, you know, novels, anything like that. We will limit ourselves and, you know, just become a subculture and a social club rather than a movement that is actually making the kind of difference that we want to make in the world. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is less sort of groups-based in nature, but I think it is one that comes up for a lot of people in this movement, which is just running yourself down or not taking particularly good care of yourself. I think it's easy to prioritize, to sort of have status attached to, like, I'm working so hard, I'm getting so little sleep, and it like sounds so cool and so like impressive, but probably not actually that great for your productivity long run. The most productive people I know seem to think pretty carefully about their self-care, like pay attention to like getting some nutritious food, getting enough sleep for whatever they need, which varies a lot by person. Really think of your efforts as, you know, being based on your long-term productivity rather than, you know, this week or this year or, you know, the next little stretch. Because if you spend your energy as if you're doing a sprint when you're actually doing like a longer term project, we don't want people to burn out when they're 24. Please don't do that to yourselves. And I think that is a real risk because this is a big project that we are interested in doing, right? Like, I'm not going to save the world. You're not, like, none of us is going to make the kind of huge impact individually that we dream about. We're never going to, like, finish the end of the project and say, like, okay, check that off my list. Like, world's okay now. We can just, like, be done. This is a project where, there's going to be more to do than any of us individually can do. And so we're never going to feel like we have reached the end of the task. So it's a big thing to think about and to feel about. And my background is in social work. So self-care is something that, if you're in a helping profession, often is like covered in your course materials. Like it's something that you talk about with your supervisor a lot. Because working in the kind of profession where you're trying to help other people all day long can be really draining. And you need to think about how you're going to do it. You need to be intentional about it. Because otherwise, it's really easy to burn out. So when I was in training to be a social worker, I was interning in a psychiatric hospital. And one afternoon, I was about the end of my shift. I was talking with a patient. And I told him, you know, it's almost time for me to go. I need to go home now. And he said, you get to go home, but I don't get to go home. And it was a really sad moment, and more sad, much more sad for him than for me. And afterwards, I asked my supervisor, like, did I do the wrong thing? Like, should I have, you know, kind of stayed later to, you know, continue hanging out with him and keeping him company? My supervisor said, no, you got to go home when it's time to go home. Like, you have to protect your boundaries. Like, you can give your all up until that limit, where you decide, like, it's now it's time to take care of myself, and deciding where those limits are and, like, when it's time to go home and have dinner with your family or do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself, that's what lets you do this for a career long, rather than burning out after, a few years. So I think that kind of self-care is needed when we're doing this in a more abstract way too. We don't, get to see the immediate sort of fruits of our labor, which in some ways can make it, I think, easier to get discouraged. And I think, this means that self-care is particularly important. And the reasons for this are not just about productivity. It's also because you are a person and your experience matters. You have intrinsic worth, and it matters whether you're okay. But I do also think that it gives you a better long-term ability to achieve your goals. So around 20% of young adults experience some type of mental illness during a given year. So statistically, this is happening to a lot of us in this movement, and it continues throughout adulthood as well. This is from 80,000 Hours. I'm just going to read this. This is from one of their career guides. Look after yourself and take care of the basics. The basics are getting enough sleep, exercising, eating right, and maintaining your closest friendships. All of these make a big difference to your energy and productivity and prevent you from burning out. If you're suffering from a mental health issue, whether anxiety, bipolar disorder, depression, or something else, then make dealing with it or learning to cope your top priority. It is one of the best investments you can ever make, both for your own sake and your ability to help others. We know people who took the time to focus intensely on dealing with serious mental health problems, and who, having found treatments and techniques that worked, have gone on to perform at the highest level. All the same applies if you have a problem with your physical health. Look after your health first. The last thing I'm going to cover is some discussion norms that I see as really tripping us up. So there's several things going on here. One is kind of going for cheap points in arguments. Another is prioritize winning an argument over seeking the truth more collaboratively. And the other is ways that we intentionally or unintentionally incentivize bad forms of discourse. So there's a tendency, I think particularly in online discussions, rather than really engaging with a particular argument, to just poke holes in it. I'm totally guilty of this, and this is something of a reminder to me also to be like better about this, because I think it's pretty important. This is like a sort of easy and entertaining thing to do. It's not particularly helpful, and a more difficult like intellectual task is trying to strengthen the other person's argument. Of course the argument has flaws, all arguments do, so if you can find those flaws and work on them, figure out like what would be a stronger version of the argument, that's a more productive task and like actually a more difficult and impressive one. If we're gonna go for signaling here, I think you could actually better in signal intelligence, for example, by doing the harder task of strengthening an argument rather than just getting some zingers in. The philosopher Daniel Dennett summarized some rules for debate written by Anatole Rapoport, who was a game theorist. He said, re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, thanks, I wish I thought of putting it that way. That's a much harder task than getting in some sort of cheap shots and making somebody else look foolish. I also think we need to prioritize seeking the truth together more than winning arguments. Again, this is something that it's like really tempting to do, but it doesn't really get us very far as a community. It doesn't really add much to our understanding of the world that we need to make a difference in it. So I think acknowledging the strengths of the other viewpoint, being honest about the weaknesses of your own, can let you get farther in terms of furthering your own understanding, the understanding of the other person you're talking to, and whoever else is observing, by getting you closer to accuracy. I think curiosity is a really important trait here, to just be seeking out ways that you might be wrong, ways that something might be different than you thought. So there are some ways that I think we often accidentally reinforce bad forms of discourse. We know that attention reinforces behavior. If someone says something, you smile and nod, or you click like, or you upvote it, you're obviously reinforcing that. You're helping them feel like they want to do more of that thing. But your unpleasant attention can also be a reinforcement. I have a two-year-old, and I can tell you that when your child is doing something annoying, yelling at them may not actually cause this behavior to happen less often. They may learn that this is actually a great way to get your attention, get a rise out of you, and like have some excitement in their afternoon. The same thing happens with adults, right? So if you're at a you're at a gathering and you see a heated debate going on, people are like arguing with each other, they seem really irritated. That's the most interesting conversation in the room. Like, that's the one that everybody wants to hear what's going on. If people are commenting back and forth on a thread, they like, comment after comment saying why the other person is wrong. Facebook's algorithm knows that's the thing that everybody wants to see. They're going to put that at the top of the feed. So unintentionally, by arguing with bad points or, bad logic, we may actually be giving it more attention, which is not presumably what we actually want to happen. It also wastes our own time. And here again, I'm showing that we all maybe read some similar comments. We probably, many of us, have wasted more time than we intended to arguing with someone who is wrong on the internet. I saw somebody else saying something I really appreciated, which is she recently almost got into this sort of argument with somebody online and then made a list mentally of all the other enjoyable things that she could do with her evening. And then she did those things instead. So I do think there is a time to, you know, try and engage with something that you really see as a problem, you know, perhaps to say, like, this is really harmful, like, let's shut down this conversation, perhaps to, you know, argue against it and explain why, you know, this thing is actually quite harmful. I think it's probably best if you do it sparingly, maybe best if you do it, you know, one-on-one rather than in a public forum. I think, you know, doing it publicly often just fuels the fire farther. So how do you reinforce the good norms that you do want to see? Model the kinds of behavior that you want to see. This is a fast-growing movement. A lot of new people are coming in, and when they come in, they look to people who are already here to see how we do things. Particularly if you've been around for a while, people do look to you to see, like, how you do this. How do you have discussions in this movement? You know, kindness is a big one. When I first started reading Less Wrong, which is a website that was formative to many of us in this movement, the first time that I ever posted a comment, it was not a well thought out comment. I admit that. And someone, you know, quickly responded to inform me of how not well thought out it was. And I thought, ouch, like, I don't want to be around these people. Like, this feels awful. And then somebody else came in, they said, like, hey, I notice you're new, like, why don't you read this, you know, sort of introduction for new people, like, you know, they asked the other person to kind of back off. And that really, like, saved my relationship with that community. Please try and be that second person, not that first person. And again, the curiosity, I think, can go so far. Our goal here is to, you know, use discussions to find out more, to get a better understanding, you know, so that we can do useful work rather than just, like, sort of having fun entertaining ourselves, really. So the upshot of this talk is that there are a lot of things that you can do that may be good for the short term. They may sort of, like, help you make some progress, you know, in the next weeks or months or year. They may make you personally sort of, like, be able to do some things. But what we should be looking for in this analogy, rather than looking for the local maximum, we should be looking for the global maximum. There may, you know, you can get up to the top of that little curve, but you need to be looking at the bigger scope of things to find the top of that largest curve that you can. And I think that is what we can do as a community, what we can do over the longer term. We should be thinking about how we can achieve the most together rather than these smaller but more obvious goals. So that's my talk. I have a couple things that you may find interesting to read. So I recently put up a post on the Effective Altruism Forum of just practical tips for people running in-person EA meetups, which I do in Boston. So those are, you know, largely for in-person groups, but also some applicable to online. Just some action steps that you can take to be more welcoming to people who may not feel particularly welcome. I also really enjoyed reading Brian Tomasik's Reasons to Be Nice to Other Value Systems about, you know, coordination and how it can get you farther than sort of taking cheap shots at each other. So. That's it. And so now I think Jeffrey and I will take some questions, or I think I may just do it that people can kind of come up like office hours for me. I don't know how Jeffrey wants to do it, but I will welcome anybody who wants to come up and ask questions or have discussion.